Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. I'm not a shy person, never really have been. I've always liked meeting strangers and starting conversations, and generally being pretty blunt in social interactions. Many times, to a fault, and I learned early on that if I wanted to make friends, I'd need to learn to apologize when people seemed off-put by my forward-leaning and sometimes selfish behavior. Like when I wanted to use the macaroni and cheese colored crayon during an art lesson in the first grade, and I just reached over, grabbed it, without knowing that the classmate that it was lying right in front of was planning on using it at basically the same time. When they pointed out my misstep, my only tool to level things out was an apology, when really I should have just learned to say the magic word, please, before grabbing the coveted crayon. The whole altercation could have been avoided, and I would have possibly had a new friend rather than a really annoyed kid who never quite warmed up to me in the remaining years of elementary school. The situations wherein I use please have definitely moved beyond crayons. But I do notice that I still operate on a system of apologizing after the fact, rather than taking the polite measure of saying please while making a premeditated request. The power dynamics around when and why we use the word please are complicated, and they become even more so when we compare how employment of the word changes from culture to culture, continent to continent, even when the language stays exactly the same. Helen Zaltzman hosts the podcast The Allusionist. She's also a resident of England and possibly the funniest person in all of podcast land. In this episode of The Allusionist, she sits down with two linguists hoping to better understand why Americans and the English use the word please in such seemingly different ways.
This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, help language complete a 1,500-piece jigsaw puzzle of John Constable's Hey Wayne, because even though we both secretly think it's boring, we do so enjoy each other's company. Coming up in today's show is a matter which I suspect will differ quite significantly from country to country and even within countries, so I'd be interested to hear how it works wherever you are. But first, a little word history, the etymology of etiquette. It's a French word and meant a label or ticket. In fact, etiquette and ticket both evolved from an older French word, estiquette, from a very old root meaning stick. Estiquette are thought to have been little tickets stuck to the wall. Possibly at first, they were written instructions for soldiers at their lodgings. But then, according to the American etiquette maven Emily Post, etiquettes were put up in King Louis XIV's garden at the Palace of Versailles, warning courtiers to keep off the lawn. And shortly, paper etiquettes were issued with all sorts of rules for genteel conduct. The word etiquette landed in the English language around the middle of the 18th century, when the Enlightenment period was in full swing in Europe, during which, among significant developments in politics and science and culture, there was a big trend for trying to elevate oneself by following ever more precise and complex codes of behaviour. It's around the same time that the word polite shifted from its original meaning of polished to its current well-mannered one. On with the show. I'm asked a lot why a word might be used differently in the US versus Britain, and the usual answer is because there's an ocean between us. Geographical distance leads to distinct evolution, hence some 80% of Australian wildlife being unique to Australia. Growing up in England, reading American books and watching American films and TV, I deduced that pants, biscuit, chips and fanny don't mean the same in the US as they did at home. But I thought I was on familiar ground with the word please. Technically, please does mean the same thing in both Britain and the USA, but I had absolutely no idea it is deployed quite differently on our respective sides of the Atlantic, until the piñata of my ignorance was smashed open by linguist Lynn Murphy, who has been researching please.
Several people have observed that the British tend to say please twice as much as Americans do, but they generally hadn't looked at if there was a reason for that other than just assuming that the British are more polite, or more particularly the English are more polite than Americans. And so we wanted to go in and look at when Americans and British people are using please and see Is it just that Americans don't bother as much, or are they using the word for different jobs?
Lynn is an American who's been living in England for the past several years.
It's not that one group is more polite than the other. It's that they've got different rules, and if you know, if you're following the rules the right way, you'll get along.
It seems like an impossible divide. It's bigger than the ocean.
You know, when I first moved here, people would say to me things like, oh, in America, you don't say please. And I'd say, pardon me, we certainly do. You know, my mother drilled it into me. You have to say the magic word before you can have anything. But after people said this to me a few times, I started to notice that when I went out to dinner with my English friends, if I ordered first, I'd just say, I'll have the Diavolo pizza or whatever. And my friends would all say, can I please have? And then when my family would come to visit, they'd order things at restaurants and I'd just have to say please at the end of each thing they ordered because I'd become so conscious that it was missing in American speech and in the English context.
They really did a number on you.
Yeah. But as we looked at it more closely, I wrote about this on my blog and a lot of people wrote in and gave their feelings about it. And the theme of the post by British people was, if you don't say please, you sound bossy. And the theme of the American commenters was, if you say please, then you sound bossy.
Please excuse me while I try to come to terms with this. I'm not a rarity among English people for using please almost as much as punctuation. Please could you pass the salt? Yes, I'd love a cup of tea, please. Please may I proofread that ransom note before you send it? I've been habitually sprinkling my speech with please to appear deferential, when all the time to Americans it was coming across as bossy and patronising.
And also, as you know, we looked into these things a little bit further, people would say things like, well, please is what a child would have to say to an adult.
Please can I go to the toilet?
Or please is what an adult would say to a child.
Please stop poking mummy in the eye. And Lynn says the English tendency to use please at the start of a request is not the done thing in the USA.
It sounds very condescending.
Oh.
Well, it can go either way. I mean, that's the thing. In American, since please is marking power distance, it could be marking either upward or downward direction of power. So if I'm ordering from you in a restaurant and I say, please, may I have this? It could sound like I'm a bit bossy. Or the way I tend to interpret it, a secretary that I work with uses it a lot. And I tend to interpret it as her debasing herself to me. Please, could we meet on Wednesday? You know, it sounds really, you know, it reminds me of Oliver.
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
More?
It sounds very much like the person is uncertain of their right to ask. Mm-hmm. Whereas in an American restaurant situation, the people involved assume what I'm doing when I order a pizza is I'm providing the waiter with the information they need to do their job. I'll have the pizza. It sounds more bossy in England, but in America, it's fine because it's not seen as a personal request to another person.
How am I ever going to master these invisible rules? For reinforcement, here's the linguist Raquel De Felice, who's been working with Lynn Murphy on the research into please.
It's basically about what the different groups of people translate please as in their heads. You know, there's the translation of please as, I am asking you something. This is just a little flag that I'm asking you something. And there's the translation of please as, I am being a polite person asking you something. And they're quite different things.
Well, one of the American sets of academics who've looked at please constantly refer to please as a word of pleading. And that's just not how it's used in British English. In British English, you use please if it's a small request, like, hello, waiter, may I have a pizza? But you wouldn't use please. You'd do something even more indirect if you were asking for something big.
When I'm asking you, can I borrow your pen? Do I have to be polite? Do I just have to flag it's a request? But if I'm asking you, can I borrow your car for a cross-country holiday? that's a really big deal. And I don't want to just do a token gesture of politeness. I want to be really, really friendly and appreciative and make it clear that I know I'm asking you a big deal. So I want to make sure that, can I borrow your car and can I borrow your pen? Don't sound the same, don't use the same structures so that you can tell that I'm aware of this huge thing that I'm asking you to do.
So therefore, is it a problem because we Brits will just fling please out willy-nilly, we'll lather things with please, and therefore there isn't the language to distinguish between the loan of a pen and a car?
I think you do distinguish, though, because then you don't say please. Then you don't say, please, may I borrow your car? You say, I know this is a really big thing to ask, and I'd really, really appreciate it. Please say no if you don't want to do this, but could I possibly ever...
If it's not too much trouble.
...borrow your car?
By that point, the person you're asking is like, whatever it is, the answer is yes, as long as you get to the end of the sentence before I die of old age.
But for Americans, if you're asking for something big, that's when you need the please. Or if there's a big power difference. And so, of course, Americans are very into making it feel like there aren't power differences in relationships amongst adults. So, you know, when you're talking to children, you get please because there's a power difference. When you're talking to your boss, you might want to have a please, but in an American context, you might not, because then you'd seem too subservient.
Let me just jot this down in my big book of transatlantic etiquette. In Britain, please would be used to dismantle a hierarchy, while in the USA, the same job would be done by the absence of please. Huh. In British English, there's also a tendency to stick please onto phrases that aren't even requests.
Please feel free to contact me. Please let me know if I can help in any way. Whereas the American writers don't do that. And that's one way of noticing that actually please is just a routine thing rather than a flag that says, I'm asking something big of you. I need to be super polite.
Another example of that is putting please on expressions of politeness. So please accept my thanks. Please accept my congratulations. And that, you know, the please is sort of, you're not asking them a favor.
You could just say congratulations.
You could just say congratulations, so, but you gotta put a please in there.
But why do people not just say congratulations? Why do they have to put in a please?
I think part of it is that the longer you make something, the more polite it sounds.
Mm. And yet you're kind of rudely taking up more of someone's
time. You are, absolutely.
This is very complicated. So can you suggest any rules that people listening can abide by so they're not gonna cause offense on either side of the Atlantic? Inadvertently.
I guess this more straightforward one is, if you're an American in Britain and you normally wouldn't use please, stick a please in it.
Yeah.
And vice versa, if you go across to America and you're British and you would normally put a please there, take the please off, although that's oversimplifying, obviously.
Yeah, I think it goes better the one way than the other. So Americans coming to Britain, say please, say thank you, say sorry, as much as you can possibly fit into your sentences.
More than you think.
Yes, if you're coming to England, say sorry at every available opportunity. If someone drops a brick on your foot, say sorry to them for having the temerity to possess a foot which obstructed the fall of their brick.
I do call that the passive-aggressive sorry. Because I used to work in a charity shop in England, and I would notice that people would run into me while I was shelving things on the bookcases, and they wouldn't say sorry unless I'd said sorry first. It was like sorry was the signal that I'd noticed that they'd done something wrong, and so I had to say sorry to get them to say sorry.
Rachele is Italian, but she's lived in the USA and Germany, and for the majority of the past 15 years, she's been living in England.
I still, after 15, 16 years, don't say sorry or thank you or please at the right time, apparently. I still sometimes ask for things in the wrong way. So I think you'll never really, unless you're born in it, you can never really fully acquire, because it's such unspoken rules.
So even if we wanted to change, we probably couldn't.
No. No, but we still like you.
Because we're so polite seeming, but it's all a facade.
And we wouldn't tell you to your face if we didn't like you, right?
Because it's not real politeness, is it?
It depends on what you mean by politeness. If what you mean by politeness is going through the motions to smooth social interaction, then that's real. That's as real as politeness gets. If what you mean is a sincere desire to be kind to somebody else, then maybe we need to call that something different, like friendliness or kindness or something like that.
And remember, we've only been talking about two forms of English. Not every language even contains please.
So it is an unnatural thing to do. I mean, anything that's social is unnatural in some way. But for instance, the Scandinavian languages pretty much don't have please. So when I'm speaking Swedish, I just end up saying thank you constantly because I'm aware that I need to be doing something polite, or I feel like I need to be doing something polite. So I just presumptuously stick thank yous in where English would have pleases.
How do they cope?
Oh, they say other things like, would you be so kind? You know, or things like that. Or they just sound bossy. But that's considered to be honest and straightforward rather than bossy.
Whereas, stereotypically, we Brits avoid being honest and straightforward. Everything has to go through at least two rounds of obfuscation. Exchanging words with other humans is an elaborate dance.
It is all about economics. You know, in social interactions is, you know, you give a bit, you take a bit, and then you have to give a bit back.
Lynn writes a great blog about differences between American and British English. It's called Separated by a Common Language. I'll link to it and her and Raquel's Twitter accounts at theallusionist.org/please. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Big thanks to Raquel De Felice and Lynn Murphy, and to Martin Austwick for the music. Please find me at Twitter and Facebook /Allusionist Show and at theallusionist.org.
For more explorations around the English language, head to theallusionist.org. The Allusionist is also a member of Radiotopia from PRX. You know, the podcast network Roman Mars started, featuring 99% Invisible, Fugitive Waves by the Kitchen Sisters, The Memory Palace, The Heart, and so many other great podcasts created by public radio rock stars. Radiotopia is on the hunt for the next great podcast idea. From now until April 17th, they're taking submissions of show ideas from anyone and everyone who wants to get into the podcast game. Find out more details on how to apply to Radiotopia's PodQuest at radiotopia.fm/podquest. That's PODQUEST. This is totally your once-in-a-lifetime chance to make that unique and previously unheard-of radio show idea into a reality with some of the coolest people on the planet. Get on it!
Please, 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 please.
Tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio producers and podcasts. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Now that we've hashed out the cultural differences around the use, and overuse in some cases, of the word please, let's go even deeper to the more basic level of how we learn language in the first place. KUT Public Radio in Austin, Texas, is the home of the podcast Two Guys on Your Head. In each episode, Dr. Art Markman and Dr. Bob Duke explore different aspects of human behavior and the brain. The two renowned psychologists cover everything from the effects of sugar on the brain to what's happening in our minds while we sleep and much more. Like this episode, about understanding the difference between behaviorism and Gestalt psychology by looking at our own language development.
Think about this.
Our brains change.
Memory isn't amazing.
What you think is in
our
there
brains aren't
really
finished. They're not fully cooked yet.
You go with your heart.
We don't have any idea why
we're
doing
so smart
most of the things that we're doing. But here's the deal. You raise a child in a language-speaking environment, and in a couple of years, they speak the language. I'm Art Markman.
I'm Bob Duke.
I'm Rebecca McEnroy, and this is Two Guys on Your Head.
And Rebecca.
Today, how we learn language.
It's interesting to think about what the brain has to do as you're learning a language. I mean, all of us who are adults who are in the presence of a language that we don't speak recognize that the language sounds like just a string of sounds, right? What linguists call phonemes, you know, just all these speech sounds just going by. We can't tell where a word stops and ends. You know, we might be able to tell larger structures as sentences because there might be natural pauses there, but I can't tell where a word ends and another word starts. So how do babies learn that? How do infants who are just listening to all that do it? And the answer, which is quite remarkable, is they learn it statistically.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that an infant would make statistical judgments.
Right. Because they're so bad at statistics by the time they get to college.
Okay. Oh my God. Yeah. But it's interesting because if you think about the way speech sounds are arranged, right, there are certain sounds that have a greater likelihood of following other sounds than other combinations of sounds, right? So as you're listening to speech sounds, what infants are doing is actually recording the probabilities of one speech sound following another one. And in doing that, they come to learn expectations about that's probably a word ending, that's probably a word beginning. And that's the way they begin to parse that uninterrupted string of phonemes and begin to understand what's going on.
First, if you think about language learning, there are several different things we need to learn. So one of them is, what are the speech sounds of my language? Another of them are, what are the words, and how do those words relate to meanings? Another thing that we need to learn is, how do you string words together into whole sentences? And then, how do you use all of this stuff to communicate with somebody else? So all of those things need to be learned, and we may not be able to do all those on one show. But let's start with, how do you learn the sounds of the language and how those emerge into words, which is what Bob was just talking about. One of the fascinating things actually about the speech sounds is we come prepared to hear all sorts of speech sounds, even though the particular language that we speak won't necessarily use all of those.
And, you know, what's kind of an interesting thing about just the rules that govern communication among human beings, when we learn to communicate effectively, we're operating with a set of rules that we can't possibly articulate, right? When children are learning to speak grammatically correctly, they couldn't possibly explain, you know, what's the direct object in this sentence. And most adults can't either, quite frankly. And
yet they use language perfectly well.
Exactly. And really, and that's the remarkable thing, right? Is that it illustrates that we didn't come to language through first learning the rules and then consciously applying the rules to create speech and to create language. And what's interesting about that too, you mentioned, you know, the possibility of learning, adults learning a second language. Is there are many approaches to that, right? And one is to say, well, let's teach you some vocabulary, and then we'll teach you some rules, and then you will apply the rules to stringing together sentences to communicate meaning. But of course, in doing that, that's a tremendously effortful process. And what discourages many adults who attempt to learn a second language but eventually just give up and say, I have no way I'm going to do this. The problem is, when they speak a language themselves, the rules are deeply embedded in their thinking in ways that they're not aware of. Yeah.
So what do you recommend for adults and adolescents who want to learn a second language or third language? Like, what is the best way to go about approaching that?
To ask the question of how do you teach adults language, you have to start asking, why is it that kids are so much better at learning language than adults? And there are several reasons. There's not a single thing. Mm-hmm. But one of the things is that adults and older kids are much more analytic in the way that they think about things and the way that they learn things in school than younger kids are. And this gets back to what Bob was saying about not being aware of the rules of language. If I'm an adult or an older kid learning a language, part of what I start doing is thinking, well, let me analyze, why did that sentence work? When in fact, that's not the way to learn those rules. The way to learn those rules is essentially to let them wash over you, to do what I call using the force, right?
Yeah.
Just do it often enough and allow those rules to emerge from you rather than trying to learn them specifically. Another piece is you have to actually use the language.
Right.
One of the things that adults hate and adolescents hate even more is to be embarrassed. And one of the best ways to be embarrassed by something is to try and speak a new language and to totally blow it. So what happens is you have to produce sentences in order to learn to speak a language. So what we do as adults is we're afraid to make a mistake. And so we don't produce anything and then we don't learn.
Right. And mistake making is a central feature of effectively learning anything. And the better you are at most of the things you do, the more aversive you find the possibility of making mistakes and things that you don't know how to do.
Right.
And as Art says, the idea of, you know, using the force, like letting it wash over you as sort of osmosis into your thinking, we say that tongue in cheek, but it really is a lot of it, right? Because our brains have the capacity to recognize patterns in language that then become a part of our thinking quite without our having to say, okay, this is the rule that I'm applying here. Mm-hmm. It isn't just the effortfulness of trying to remember all the rules. It's the avoidance of the idea that I'm going to wait to say something until I know exactly how this sentence is supposed to come out. Well, you're toast. Yeah. Right? You're not going to say anything, because all the time that you're spending doing that, the occasion that would have prompted you to want to say something has now gone.
Right.
So to put yourself in a situation where you're around either other people who are learning the language, or even better, native speakers who are patient with you, to allow you to try things out and make mistakes and learn from those mistakes is the most effective way to learn anything new, but particularly learning a language.
To check out this and other episodes of Two Guys and find more information on any of the topics we've discussed, go to KUT.org. Two Guys on Your Head is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Rebecca McEnroy. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at KALW.org. Just look under the Programs tab. I want to know about the podcasts that you regularly listen to. Send your suggestions in an email to thespot@KALW.org. And tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.